We can go ahead and start. Well, first, I wanted to thank you for your time. I really appreciate it. And I think it's really great to have you because not only have I enjoyed our other conversations we've had in the past, I think I like how it flows and our similar points that we agree with attachment. But I think that your knowledge you have and your experience is really align and confirm what our concept is as a family center, and that it takes a village to raise a child, and the purpose from the beginning of our family center was to build a community, and a lot of your work that you have done supports this and the power of it. So I thought we could go ahead and start with, as much as I want to get into this discussion about a lot of this work you've done, I thought maybe we could set a foundation for the parents on what attachment theory is. And I thought the great way we could do that is I noticed in your book you had a section that was attachment theory and daycare. And I thought maybe you could explain that a little bit. Yeah, we could start with that.
Sure. Yeah. Thank you very much for the invitation. It's my pleasure to spend parts of this afternoon, of my afternoon for you. It's a different time with you and the audience we hopefully will have. And yeah, I like the way you are approaching children's development and caring for children, and that you center more on the community instead of only highlighting the parent-child relationship when you're talking about the village or the family center. I think that is a much needed approach that is pretty different from what is going on right now in most of the daycare institutions in Germany that I know, and probably in large parts of the Western world. Yes, attachment is, as it is usually introduced, the biggest and most famous theory of children's socio-emotional development, and it was developed by the British child psychiatrist and psychoanalyst John Bowlby in the 1950-1960 years, and it really represented a new approach because it was shifting attention away from the cognitive domains to the socio-emotional domain of children's development. And he was interested in many things beyond his own discipline. So he was interested in ethology and evolutionary theory and systems theory. So in many things, and he knew people from these different areas, and he was receptive of what they were studying. And so he compiled what he called attachment theory as a conception that is describing children's attachment formation with primary caregivers. And although in the beginning there was a lot of mentioning of the family, he and his followers then became very concentrated on the mother as the major attachment figure for a child. And there is a couple of basic or core assumptions that he formulated. One relates to the evolutionary foundation that the attachment system has developed over the history of humankind in order to be advantages for the selection, since children who are cared for, who are protected, survive better. than children who are exposed to all the environmental threats and dangers. There was a particular assumption about the emergence of attachment related to the parenting quality. There was particularly the conception of sensitivity of responding to infant signals, which was particularly elaborated by Mary Ainsworth, a Canadian American psychologist who joined him and collaborated with him for many years. There is a universality assumption that means that attachment, he related it to the evolutionary foundation, is a universal process that everywhere is important, is emerging the same way and has the same consequences. And there were assumptions about the consequences of the quality of attachment development, the so-called competence assumption, that means that children who are securely attached to their primary caregiver build have a better prospect for their future development. So they are in any case more emotionally developed, they have better cognitive skills. So yeah. In the long run, it was related to almost everything, even to risky driving behavior and things like that, that obviously cannot be related to the theory.
Right, yeah.
In any case, it was not very popular in the beginning, but gradually became very popular. And one of the major applications it experienced was, in fact, early education. With the increasing necessity of caring for children outside the home, related to societal conditions of women's entering the labor force, etc., the daycare institutions became much more organized according to family functioning. And the whole setup of the daycare, the importance of the numbers of adult caregivers, the ratio, which has become the major aspect of the quality definition, has become crucial. So ideally, one adult is dealing with one child in a particular sensitive way, respecting the children's needs and wishes, and responding to those, so letting the children the lead. And if you analyze the usual daycare setting in Germany, you can find much of these assumptions that attachment theory postulated for the functioning family, for the daycare and kindergarten setting. And meanwhile, it has also conquered, so to speak, other domains, from child custody decisions to child placement decisions to social work, to almost all domains of applications in social sciences are related to attachment theory.
Yeah, that's so true. It's something that I think educators don't even recognize that they're participating in this theory. In a sense, like, for example, if a child is sick or gets hurt, the first person you call is the mother, you know? Exactly. And this goes along with the attachment theory that you shared, that the mother is the soul, the first primary attachment that the child has. So it's things that... that people don't even recognize that you're following this theory.
Right. There's a lot of implicit assumptions that you take for granted and you don't think about it, that it is a cultural conception. And since you're mentioning the child is hurt and ask for the mother. The same is happening in the daycare institution. A child is crying or is sad or something. The other children notice that very well, but they go and ask an adult teacher to take care of the child. So it would not occur to them to console a child themselves. Also, they are very able to do so.
That's so true. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. And this is so different in other cultures. In Japan, for instance, there are studies demonstrating that children take care of each other. They help each other. They kind of consolidate fighting children. They never ask a teacher, and a teacher would never intrude in such a ongoing conflict or any situation. Right. So it's very culture specific.
Right. And so then my question would be is, how do you teach such a thing when it's already so embedded in our culture, the westernized way of caregiving? How do you change it? How do you teach this, that you give the responsibility to the child, to the as a communal group, you know?
That's a very good question, because that is very difficult, because it goes against the inner conviction of people. So they just think it's not good for children and you can't do this. And they even, parents who have a different attitude to child rearing and good care for children, they even evaluated by daycare teachers. I have seen and witnessed this several times that they say you are not interested in your child's well-being. You can't do this. You have to behave like this and that. And there you see that what we think is very normative. We think what we think is correct and it's the best, and all the other people have to do the same. And in order to change it, you first have to learn to change your perspective, to understand that your way of seeing things is just one among many others. Mm-hmm. And there is not per se one better or one worse. Mm-hmm. But they have an equal right, and you have to understand that families, and I explicitly do not talk of parents only, families have an inherent interest in the best development and in the well-being of their children. So they do everything they think is important, but in any case, depending on the cultural value system, this may look completely different, even contradictory. What we think in the Western middle class world may be regarded as treating children bad or child abuse. For instance, when we did research in Cameroonian villages or Indian villages, and we were telling families that in Germany, small babies already have to learn to sleep in their own bed.
Yeah,
and to sleep alone and sleep through the night, they thought we are kidding them.
Right,
this
I know.
This cannot be the case. I mean, yeah.
And that's a starter point there too. And it's so interesting. I don't know where it started. That, you know, parenting books said that you must put their child in their own bed. I mean, for me, yeah, it didn't happen because the child, it wasn't comfortable for them. So in the end, it's like, okay, what's the best way we all get sleep? We all sleep together. So, you know, it's interesting how we train and condition the children and ourselves to be so much against our human instincts and our human nature. And yeah.
And that young mothers, we have often observed this in programs, that they go against their inner feelings.
Yeah.
Because
they read it in a book that
exactly.
said,
exactly.
You need
yeah.
to do this. Yeah.
They have read, there are these horrible books, How to Train Children to Sleep.
Yeah.
And then they follow this and they suffer themselves hearing their children crying, but they don't interfere because they say, I mean, this is a horrible thing. They do the wrong thing and think it is the best they can do instead of just listening to their inner voices.
Mm-hmm. And not feeling that there has to be a strict routine and that there has to be a schedule, because children are different every day, you know, and their moods and their emotions are different, and us to think for them that they have to do the same thing every day, it's just not realistic, you know. I have a question, because you also mentioned, I was watching a little video that you had done, and you touched base on like the hierarchy of attachment. What exactly does that mean? What was the purpose of?
The assumption of attachment theory is that a child can only build meaningful relationships with, as they call it, with one or few people, and that many people in the environment of a child confuse a child and prevent the child from proper development. And this is why attachment theories think that even if a child has two or three people caring for it and has developed relationships with these people, there must be one person, the primary caregiver, as they call it. That one person must be the one whose the child is attached most, in the sense that the child is sad when this person leaves the room, or only this person can console the child, or things like that. So whereas in other cultures, children have caregiving networks with functions that are interchangeable. So there are many people who can take care of a child. Sometimes there are studies demonstrating in particular cultural groups in the east of Africa that children, babies, during the first months of life have 20 different people who are regularly taking care of them, and that they switch the bodies, so to speak. So they go from arm to arm like 20, 30 times within 30 minutes. So it's a complete different understanding. And people think children are becoming sad and it's not good for them when they are only with a few people. And also in the Western middle-class ideology, it's also the philosophy that children need time on their own, that they want to be alone. Yeah. And so this is why children, we did a study once where we were really measuring and counting every second that children were alone during the normal day or spend with others. And children spend as much time alone as they spend in these close, intimate, dyadic relationships. It's like 30 to 40% of the day. And that's a lot for a small child. And this is why objects are so important also in our child-rearing ideology. So children have their security blanket, they have their favorite, I don't know what, bear or monkey or whatever, and they cannot sleep without this and that. And they are surrounded by toys, because you could even say we deprive them from social contact and try to replace it with This sounds a little bit harsh, but that's actually what's happening.
Yeah, that's so true. Wow. Yeah.
And this is so different. Children also are in many other parts of the world, they are not interested in objects. And this is why it is also not fair to do these developmental tests that have been developed in the West with children who have different social experiences, because they do not follow the sound of a bell, or they do not follow the shape of a rectangle or anything, but they follow every movement a person is doing. But this is not assessed in the test, so the children fail, although they have wonderful competences, but they are not recognized in these tests. So there is also a lot of ethical problems related to transporting this ideology of child rearing to everyone.
Yeah, I noticed you had another chapter on the ethical points of it.
Yeah, I think it's very important to think about what we are doing. See, the major international organizations like UNICEF and World Health Organization, World Bank, and numerous NGOs, they all follow the conviction that 250 million children under the age of five worldwide do not reach their full developmental potential. And that this can only be reached when we train the mothers primarily to do what Western middle class parents should do, interacting with their children. And this way we not only interfere into a functioning culture, in the worst sense, but we also do not respect local cultures, and we act not in the reality of these people. So we create an artificial reality. And so together with a couple of colleagues, we are very active in this field of particularly these developmental aid and intervention programs. Huge amounts of money are wasted in this sense, and sometimes also applied to the worst of the children, which could be spent in much more meaningful ways. So it's a real problem.
I have a question about the cover of your book. I wanted to know how you went about choosing it, and does it have a significance? Maybe I should get a better pull up of the picture of the cover.
Yeah, I actually like that picture very much.
Yeah, me too. That's what I'm curious to hear. I want to hear about it. Give me 1 second. I'm going to
pull
it up in a better save as a picture. Sorry. Okay, and then I'll share it. There we go. Okay, stop sharing this one, and now I will share this one. Okay, can you see it?
Yeah.
Okay, perfect. Wonderful. Yeah, I mean.
Yeah, see, it's a piece of tribal art from India, from the state of Gujarat.
Okay.
And it's a wall painting, actually, which I found, and I took also the photograph at a school center for these tribal children and adolescents that I was visiting with my Indian colleagues. Mm-hmm. And I like it very much because I cannot explain all the different symbols, but obviously it's about rural life, and it's about local plants and birds and things.
And the sun and the moon and the plant growing, it looks like a community.
And so it's reflecting the reality of life in this area. And the inner circle is kind of of part of a different philosophy of life, that life is not here is it starting with birth and here is it ending with death, but life is a cycle which is much more connected also in the different layers with other people and to the outside world, and it's open. So I think that is this symbolism that I like.
It's beautiful. I really like it. Yes.
Yeah. I had a different proposal for my publisher, also another painting that I took in Mexico, and it was painted flowers in very strong colors, but he thought that's not serious enough.
Okay.
This very colorful painting.
Ooh, I would love that too. Just to see that, maybe you can send it to me. I'm curious, because I was also very fascinated with this one also. So I'm curious to see what your first choice was. But
yeah, I would send it to you. Sure. No, but I really like this too. So I made the selection of a couple of pictures. So I'm not a good photograph. And but I where I go, I take pictures with my cell phone.
Yeah,
some come out really nicely.
Like yeah,
one, so yeah, that the quality is enough also to print them.
Yeah, I feel like it speaks a lot. There's a lot of power and a lot of things you can read into this. I think it's great. So the more I talk to you, the more cool research projects I hear that you do. It's amazing. I mean, there's been so many and I have so many questions, but I guess my question would be, what has been your most profound or most fascinating research project you've done?
That's difficult because I'm always very enthusiastic because what I'm doing.
All of them. Yes. Yeah.
And as you can imagine, I have worked for a long time in this field, and so I have done quite.
I mean, people can work in the field for a long time and still not get involved like you do. Your way of thinking and how you choose to study something and how to do the research, I mean, it's very inspiring.
Thanks.
But I
think that's a matter that maybe you cannot learn it or so. It's a matter also of personality. So I'm a very curious person.
Yeah.
And I love to know, and I'm basically interested what other people are doing. And I always was interested in small children. I love to talk to small children. I think that's hilarious sometimes. And I learned so much about their perspective talking to them. So these days it's not possible, but I used to go regularly to a kindergarten where I'm good friends with the headmaster, and I mm-hmm. could spend there just a couple of hours talking to the children, moving around, sitting with them. And these are the lessons where I really learned a lot, and much of the research I've done was I didn't have an analytical strategy. I want to do this or I want to achieve that. So I changed topics often, and there were so many things that happened by chance. And the funny thing is, and the good thing as well, is that in the end, it looks like a pre-planned research program that I had set up and then systematically followed. But it's a big series of random decisions.
Well, I think the thing is too, when you use children for feedback or, to get research, children, they don't have filters. They don't have this invisible standard that they feel that they have to appease. They give you the raw, honest answer. And I think that was really awesome too, a project you were working on with Orr, that you weren't only getting the feedback from the children. And what most importantly you wanted to be careful of is that we weren't interpreting the meaning of what the child was saying. You were truly trying to get the meaning from the child and not what our perception.
Yeah, or it's wonderful. He really has a gift to talk to children and to interview children. And children tell him the most amazing things. And that is the art that you find really, that you can relate to the children. And the children, the same thing as with people in other cultures, if they feel you are really interested in what they have to say and you don't want to exploit them or you don't want to manipulate them or anything, if you're just interested the way they think children should be raised or any other question, they are telling to share. And Orr did wonderful interviews with the children, and his research, I think, contributes also to correcting parts of attachment theory, because attachment theory defines the child's perspective. They define what is in the interest of the child and what does the child need and what does the child want. And then they develop scenarios reflecting exactly the pre-chosen options. Children mm-hmm. see things completely differently. Mm-hmm. See, I made very many years ago, one of the young men working with me brought his little son to the lab. And I liked this little son very much. And of course, I was obviously much taller than him. And I was talking to him and I thought, I have to bend my knees to be on an equal height with him. And what did he do? He did the same. So, and that opened my eyes. I said, what we think we have to adapt to the children's perspective, they have a complete different attitude. He did what I did. Right. And that was his way. He wanted to participate. He wanted to, express his way of seeing our conversation in the same way I did. Yeah. So if you are curious and you also notice those kind of little happenings.
Yeah, they're the small little details that have so much meaning, right? Yeah.
Definitely. And if you learn from them and then you start taking these events and apply it to your research and think, maybe children do not need an adult to help them. They're most willing to help themselves. And we can observe this in other cultures that this is actually happening. Then we also have to ask ourselves, are we doing the best thing for our children, raising them the way we do? And I think this ongoing process of learning and learning from having the privilege to work in so many other universities and to talk to people in so many different living circumstances. I think that was the most fascinating aspect of my research and what I thought was most important also. I mean, reading and knowing the theory. I was in a research program when I was very young, where I got funded from the German Research Council. And it was mainly science people there. I was the only psychologist. And they told me, but you never talk about your own observations, your own opinion. You have your Piaget book on your knees and then you first look up and read whether this is correct what you are seeing. And this is also a lesson that I learned. I do not have to say, yes, Piaget has observed this and therefore I have a right also to see these things. I can see and I can make sense and then I can discuss this. In qualitative research, we have this method of member checking. That means we are interviewing people, we are analyzing the interviews, we are interpreting, we are making sense of the interviews, and then we give this information back to the people whom we interviewed and ask them, does this also make sense to you? Is this how you are seeing
right. the thing?
Or are we are working with cultural key informants, as we are calling them, like shamans with Indian people in Costa Rica, or with rabbis in Israel, or with midwives in many communities. So people who have a particular knowledge of that community. And then we give them what we found and say, does this make sense for your people? Would you sign this as a correct document?
And that's beautiful. That's how it should be, you know?
Yeah, it's important. It's really important. We cannot, like what attachment is doing, they are making sense in their own limited ways of doing things. And then we tell people, you have to do this. This is the way you should behave.
What was it? They said from like scientific-based study, you know?
Right.
It's like a cause and effect one after the other, but it's like one thing can happen, but it can go 10 different ways. It doesn't just go one way.
Yeah, and that's the fascinating thing. Also, see, attachment research is what we call in psychology, they have a confirmation bias. They are only looking for approvals of their theory, and they ignore every other anthropological or whatever evidence that things are different. So they are not interested in, and that is not a scientific way of doing things. And I mean, people like I am, and many people working in the area, we are interested and open. And of course, we also have our ideas and our assumptions, but we are ready to modify them, to abandon them, to develop new ones. So we want to understand what people are really thinking and why they are behaving the way they do. People may do the same, and they also may tell us the same thing. For instance, we did a study on breastfeeding, mm-hmm. and we were asking women in Indian villages, in Los Angeles, in Berlin, middle-class families, in many different locations, what do you think of breastfeeding? Is it good for children? They all said, it's great, it's wonderful. But the reasons why they thought so was completely different. So there were completely different meaning systems behind that common view. That shows that we have to go into the depths of things and do not stay at the surface. Okay, people are alike everywhere. They all like breastfeeding. They all like this and that. They all like children play, but they understand completely different things. What is understood as children's play. So and this is important to learn from the people and to learn with the people. I'm just working right now in a different group where conceptions for cultural conscious development of ECCE, early care and education programs will be developed. And we definitely quit talking about we develop for this community. We want to develop with the community. And first, we have to assess whether there is a need. What I was mentioning before, the 250 million children that do not reach their full developmental potential. So there is no need assessment. But what does it mean? It's just the rate of poverty which is taken. And this is equating poverty with bad development for children and with bad parenting. This may be the case, but it is not necessarily so. We first have to prove whether this in this particular location is in fact the case. And then we have to develop programs with the people there because they only know how best they could be helped, and not from outside on the basis of complete different circumstances.
Right. It's so interesting because you think about this and it becomes an overwhelming thought, because there does need to be so much change. Not, you know, I've already felt it in the education system. I definitely didn't push education too early on children. I think the first 6 years should just be teaching children self-awareness, how to handle conflict, what are emotions, socializing, things like this, before we have them in such a structured setting. You know, I feel like we're really killing their spirits of their being a child and wanting to explore. And, you know, so then with this thought, then it goes into this whole myth of attachment and parenting. And it's like, oh, everything is so, you know, it becomes overwhelming, because you want to help and make a difference and change, but it has to be so big.
I think what you were saying is so correct. And we have to let children deal with each other. It's so important that children have room for getting along with each other, for develop ideas together. And also children love to do the same as other children do. They do not want to be the unique, wonderful child all the time. Yeah. They want to be like all the others. I also, one of these lunch conversations in the kindergarten, I was sitting with 3-4 kids on a table, and we were talking about favorite dishes. And one child said he likes, I don't know what the expression is, it's like a piece of meat with a slice of ananas, and a piece of cheese melted.
Okay.
On top. There is this 50 years dish, Toast Hawaii, where this was with ham and fruit and cheese, and this exists also with meat. So one child told me he likes this the best. And all the other children said, me too, me too. And I bet they even didn't know what it was. But they wanted to be all the same and all alike. And that is also something that we do not children allow to be. They have to be unique all the time.
Yeah, or better or faster or...
Right, yeah.
Yeah. I really do feel for our children. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, I grew up in the same education system as my children will and as the children are now. And of course, you know, I feel very fortunate. I'm very happy and humble of my upbringing, but to see it now in the educator's perspective and my perspective, personal opinion, yeah, it's interesting. There's just so much change that needs to be done. And, you know, in Germany, you're not allowed to homeschool. So even if you didn't agree with the system, you have to participate, you know, and I just think putting children at the age 6 and expecting them to sit still and be quiet for so many hours of the day and then send them home with a happy or a sad face, you know, I don't know what is our, I don't think that's the purpose of our being here, you know?
So. Yeah, but you know, I don't know actually why it is so difficult to change paradigms in the educational field. Mm-hmm. It's such a slow process, and particularly also the decision makers. So the people
in the ministry. A lot of the decision makers have never been in a classroom, and I think that's another hard part too.
Yeah, you know. But they have this, you know, now I'm very stereotypic, I know, but it's my experience. I have worked a lot together in this Lower Saxonian Institute with the ministry and politicians. They want to have two-page summaries at the utmost, mm-hmm. and they want to have clear instructions, and they want to, they don't want to deviate from what they think is mainstream. So if we tell them, for instance, which we try to do for some time, that language training needs to be done completely different from what it is done, you may even convince them in a personal conversation, but they won't go and talk about these things publicly, that we are doing things wrong and that we have to change things, because they do not want to lose voters, and they yeah. they do not want to stick out of the right. what they understand the mainstream is, and they do not follow scientific claims, or yeah. they also often take what is what is easy to understand. The easier you formulate your ideas, the more success you will have. I know this is horribly stereotypic. There are also, I also know people in ministries who are great and yeah. who are really reading and proving things, but you often get the impression
I definitely agree with you for sure. And it is, it's, you know, there is just much more of the ones who do stay on the lighted path instead of trying to, you know, to explore the other ways, because there is more than one way, like we said. Okay. And I think it's just too much of a system that's so deep, hard, it's hard to get through, you know? So even these people who do recognize, okay, yeah, there is a better way, but you don't know where to begin to make the change. And that's, that's what I feel. And yeah, I guess it's just baby steps.
You know, if there would be only one way, humankind wouldn't exist anymore. Because right. humans exist because of variability, of genetic variability. And of course, we are born with what we call open programs. That is the capability of learning. We mm-hmm. are born with predispositions, with particular interests in particular things, and so on, with the ability to hear and to process information and mm-hmm. to develop a memory and all these things. But how it is actually happening is dependent on the context information, on the input we are getting. Mm-hmm. If we would have one fixed way, we wouldn't survive, because we have to adapt to extremely different environmental conditions.
Right, but I almost think we are getting close to the one fixed way.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Scary.
And that's so wrong. And that's also completely misunderstood evolutionary theory. Evolutionary theory is a context theory, and attachment theory is saying this same kind of emotional bond is important everywhere, and it always and everywhere develops on the basis of sensitive caregiving, sensitive responsiveness. This is just a complete misunderstanding of what evolutionary theory is about. So, right. yeah.
Well, I do have to say, you did share very helpful, I mean, eye-opening, and we can do a whole nother session on this book, but The Hunt Gather Parent. I mean, just the beginning, just to talk about what we do as a culture with children, you know, somebody said a perfect way that, you know, we push, we pull them, we control, and we correct children, you know, we don't give them that freedom to explore on their own, and us just be simple guides to help, you know, when they have a question or when they want more insight. Yeah. You know, we're too busy doing all the small and big things for them that children are losing. They said, yeah, they're having fewer skills. They're getting less executive function because we're taking their learning experience.
Absolutely. And yeah. we are not aware of doing it. We think we support the development of all these things.
Right.
You think the best way. Yeah, mm-hmm. we are not aware. And that is also something what you were addressing earlier, what can be done to change things. We have to first understand ourselves better and to see what are our implicit assumptions, what are the taken for granted assumptions, and what are we doing? And if, since you were mentioning this book, Hunt Gather Parent, this mother who is the author of this book, she started counting the number of orders she was giving to her child. And then she became very surprised by an enormous amount of orders she was giving within a short period of time, but she wasn't aware before that she did so. And this is so this self recognition is very important.
That's right. What your role is, what is your role affecting in this whole scheme?
Right. Yeah.
And what else I found really powerful from it was the fact, and this is the biggest kind of wraps back into our family center concept. And it's that, you know, now the family is considered parent and kid.
Yeah.
Mom and dad, kid, mom, kid, however it goes.
Yeah.
You know, and in other cultures, it's not that. It's a community. You have the cousins, you have the grandmas, you have the aunts, you have the neighbor. And
you have siblings.
Right, which we talked about the other day. And the easiest thing is just to ask for help, you know? And I think that we live in a culture that is scared to ask for help. You know, we think that we have to do it all in order to be a good parent. And that's not the case at all. You're actually disadvantaging your parenting abilities by trying to do it all. Yeah. And I just found it really powerful. And you know, when I came up with this whole vision with the family center and stuff, you know, building a community was just something that I felt was needed, and it came naturally. I didn't need to read a book. So it feels good to know that I feel what we're trying to build here at Rainbow Trekkers is something that is very follows the human nature way. And I think there's a lot of potential.
That's wonderful. As I said in the beginning, but you are wonderfully describing also that you have like an inner voice or a kind of a conviction that comes on naturally, and you don't have to read necessarily first the book. Sure, you are checking things obviously afterwards, but first you have a sentiment and a vision something and
right.
a feeling.
Thank you. I appreciate that. It really did help confirm it because, of course, you know, it's a nice idea. Sometimes I think I get a little bit fairy tale-in, but in this case, it was like, wow, okay, I'm on the right path. Okay, my thinking is
absolutely,
serves a purpose. And
you know, there is this interesting, I'm such an intuitive thinker, as you describe yourself. And when I was young, because the world around us is analytical, I thought my thinking capacities is not very well developed. But gradually I learned the contrary. I had a colleague in Osnabrück, a mathematician, who did studies on mathematical learning and task solution and things like that. And she found out, she was comparing boys and girls. She was interested in gender questions. And she was only comparing the working strategies of children who could solve mathematical problems, boys and girls. And she found out that boys used a different strategy than girls.
Mm-hmm.
Girls came up with the right solution and couldn't explain how they got to it.
Uh-huh.
Whereas boys could analytically explain this and that leads to this and that and so on. And I think I learned a lot from this study. That is also something that also has been described for language learning, that there are these two approaches also. And it's not even a cultural difference. Also, it is also one, but there are also inter-individual differences. And girls obviously need, seem to tend more to this intuitive kind of reasoning, but it's leading to the same good, correct result. And we have to really adopt this this strategy and be proud that we are able to do so.
Right. But it's funny because even when you're in a working environment, in order to be able to go on with an idea that you have that you can't explain how you've gotten there, it's hard to do it in a working environment because they want so much explanation and documentation of each how you segue there. And I feel very lucky that I'm in a position that I'm having this freedom of having the idea and letting it grow from there. So but a lot of other cases aren't like that. So
yeah, that's true. But maybe we also need to find other ways to introduce our thoughts when when we have a feeling and maybe cannot express exactly, but we have a vision and we see a direction in which it's going. We may kind of visualize our ideas. There is this in anthropology. There is this. I forgot the expression doesn't occur to me, but you give children or also adults, whomever, something to take photos. And then you send people around, they should take pictures of everything that is important to them. And then you, after that, you talk to them what everything means and you get a better understanding and compared to just talking about it and explain what is important in your environment and where do you direct your attention to. And if you first let them take pictures and then.
Yeah, I've heard of this activity before. I've actually never done it before, but I'm sure that it's.
It's interesting. We have done it in different respects. Our drawings also. We also work a lot with children's drawings or family drawings, and these are alternative approaches where we start talking and explaining about things in a later step and not start with it. So.
Right. But it's interesting, as much as I feel like we oppress children's intuitive beings, I think as adults, it's happening too, you know, that there when you want to give an adult a task and you say, I need to know exactly how you got to all of it, instead of just being, okay, you got to it. That's good. You know, we're killing our initiative, following our intuition, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, Heidi, thank you so much. I could talk to you all day long and I would love to do that. But yeah, I think our time is up. But I would love to maybe in the future do more of these kind of discussions.
Sure. It is great fun to talk to you, for me too. And so let's continue.
Yeah, that would be great.
There are so many things we can talk about and maybe we develop even good ideas.
Yes, maybe we can come up with a research idea. That would be so fun.
Yeah, that would be great too, yeah.
Mm-hmm. A very big thank you to from me, Heidi. This has been very interesting.
Thank you very much.
Of course, I'm a member of Rainbow Tracker, currently in maternity leave though, but I'm currently doing a proposal for my PhD in learning development with human development combination. So this has been very insightful for me. Thank you.
That sounds interesting, what you want to do.
Thank you.
And you're welcome to Heidi. Is so wonderful. You can write her an email also. She's very good at replying and
absolutely, yes.
Sharing information. So
yes.
And also, Heidi, you're welcome to share if you come across anything exciting or thrilling that you think would be of interest within our what we've discussed in our family center concept.
Yeah.
Don't be shy to share.
Definitely. Yeah. We'll be in touch, Ashley, anyway.
That sounds great. All right, then I wish you both a nice Feierabend and stay warm and happy holidays.
Have a nice day ahead of you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.